My name is Robert. I am an alcoholic. Sobriety date is December 25th, 1995. My home group is Sober at Six, which meets here Tuesday through Friday. And it's the greatest home group in the world. And if you don't feel that way about your home group, I suggest you go out and find one that you can feel that way about. You know, I'd like to thank Chuck for his kind words. I'd like to thank each and every one of you for coming out here to support me tonight. It's not always an easy job to get up in front of a group of people and tell the truth. You know, because I'm usually used to lying like hell. You know? But, you know, I certainly didn't start out to end up as a low bottom drunk. But somewhere along the line, it ended up that way. And in the third edition, I'd like to read a little something. This comes from A Teenager's Decision. It comes from page 353. This is the third edition. And this is kind of the way it was for me. Because I never drank socially. I drank as often and as much as I could. My eventual goal was to drink myself to death. All my life, it seemed, was spent on the outside looking in. I had been unhappy, lonely, and scared for so long that the discovery of liquor seemed to be the answer to all my problems. But it began to be an awfully painful answer as hangovers, blackouts, trouble, and remorse set in. And, I was born on March 10th, 1961. I was born on St. Croix Indian Reservation in Round Lake, Wisconsin. And I heard somebody saying here one time, you know, that whatever year it was they was born, that was the best year of their life. And that's the way that my life was. The year that I was born was probably, the day that I was born was probably the best year of my life. From that moment on, my life headed south and just continued to go that way for the next 30-some years. You know, I was taken away from my family when I was 6 months old, and I never saw my family ever again. Or I did, but I'll get back to that if I can. I have a lot to say, very little time to say it in. But, I was put up for adoption, and these feelings of not being, you know, being loved, being unwanted, you know, not feeling like I belonged anywhere, you know, came to me at an early age, and I was bounced around from a lot of what I say tonight was told to me. A lot of what I say tonight, I've heard and I've found out, but some I remember, not much. I was in an adoption home after adoption home after adoption home till I was 3 years old. And a family from Illinois adopted me. And I was, like I said, I was 3 years old. And I've always got to this point and always really tried to say something nice about these people. And that's about as far as I can go. And I don't want to get into, of what happened. But all I know is, you know, that it happened. And I can't unchange it. I can't undo it. And, you know, for many years I spent, even at a little bit, as a little bitty boy, planning their demise. I was 6, 7, 8 years old planning on how I would kill these people. And if I ever found them dead, what I would do on their graves. And that's really the way that I felt. And see, when I came in here, it was really hard for me to work on these four steps. You know, it was really hard, you know, when we talk about this resentment prayer. Because the only thing that I could do when it got to that resentment prayer was the only thing I could say to God was, I'm going to pray for these people. I'm supposed to pray for these people. And those are the only words that could come out, was I'm going to pray for these people. You know, today, I can get up here today as a result of this program and say that I forgive them. But they still have to meet their maker. And I'm grateful for that. I'm grateful that they have to stand before their creator and answer for the things that they have done to other people. I don't remember my first drink. I know it was somewhere around the age I was probably 4 or 5 years old. Because of the things they had done to me, the things they had said to me, the names they had called me, and all the things that happened in my life. And when I read that page, you know, that's the way that I drank. That's the way that I felt. You know, I had planned to drink myself to death. And I had hoped and begged many years to die. And I never died. I never died. You know? And always came to. I'd like to read another little something from page 548. It says, the only reality I was able to face had been forced upon me by its very repetition. I had to drink. I did not know that there was anything in the world that could be done about it. See, when I was 5 years old, when I was 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years old, I had to drink. And I didn't know that there was anything in this world that could be done about the way that I felt, thought, drank, or did anything. I didn't know anything about Alcoholics Anonymous then. And, you know, when I walked in here, I didn't know that if anything could get me sober. I had tried many years to try to quit drinking. I promised many people that I would quit. Any time and every time that I had ever promised or told somebody that I would quit, you know, mainly my ex-wife, she hooked a lie detector up to me. And I would have passed the lie detector test. Because I swear that every time I took that drink, and I came to, and I told my ex-wife or my kids or my boss or anybody, whoever it was, as far as drinking is concerned, it's over with. I will never do it ever again in my life. And I'm in it. And the same things that these people did to me, I began to do to other people. And they would tell me about these things. And I'll never do it again. I promise. I swear. I'll be on my knees. Please forgive me. Please. Because that was not me. I've had wives. I've had kids beg me. Please. Please don't go drink tonight. Please. I swear I won't do it. I swear. And I could never make it through the day. I could never make it through my day. Somewhere between the time that I woke up until the time it was that I came home, I don't know what happened. I don't know what, you know, and the book talks about that. You know, the book talks about those firm resolutions. Never could hold to them. One thing I come to find out, you know, is, you know, I'm an alcoholic and I had to drink. I had to. I've never taken one drink in my life that I wanted to take. All through grade school, all through high school, I drank. When I was probably 11 or 12 years old, and see, these people that had adopted me didn't know what was the matter with me. They didn't know that I was alcoholic, and they couldn't see the abuse that they had put me through was making me drink, and that I was trying to run and hide from all the things that the mean and nasty things they were saying and doing to me. So they send me to counselors, psychologists, psychiatrists, this type of therapist, this type of psychoanalyst, this, you know, and they probably spent hundreds of thousands of dollars on me, you know, trying to find out what the hell was the matter with me. And I came here, and I know what's the matter with me. I'm an alcoholic. There are a lot of drugs in my story. I want to say this right now. There are a lot of drugs in my story. Probably more so than the alcohol. But because this is a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, I want to respect and honor Alcoholics Anonymous tonight and the people who are just a pure alcoholic. But just remember that when I talk about these things, there's some hardcore drug use in here. Sometimes, you know, and there was a point in my life where my best friend told me, you make a better drug addict than you do an alcoholic, man. That sent me over the edge, you know. I was like, shit, man. You know, that's my way out. And I put the alcohol down, man. I can do what I want. It didn't work. I was seeing this counselor one time. I was probably 11 or 12 years old, and this young lady used to take me. She asked me one of the first times that I ever saw her, she said, what would you like to do? I said, I'd like to go somewhere where somebody ain't going to beat the hell out of me. And I said, I'd like to be able to lay down on a blanket and just look up at the sky and just talk to somebody and just be able to say whatever it is that I want to say, just to get it out. And I don't want nobody to hit me. I don't want nobody to say anything. And one of these times that I was doing this, she used to do this to me every two or three times a week. And after about the third or fourth, fifth, I don't know how many times I went and saw her, I was laying on this blanket and I was looking up at the sky, and I don't know what was going on through, you know. I don't even remember what I was saying. I don't remember anything that I ever said to her. But I remember she asked me, she said, I want to ask you one question. She said, are you an alcoholic? And I'm 11 or 12 years old. You know, when I was 13 years old, there was a movie on TV that I had to watch. It was Sarah T, The Portrait of a Teenage Alcoholic. And I watched this movie. And this movie was me. You know, even before I was a teenager, I began to understand that I had a problem. But I didn't know that there was anything that I could do about it. Because I couldn't go to my parents and tell them. I couldn't go to the teachers. Because anything I said to a teacher, they went right back to my parents. Anything I said to the police, they went right back to my parents. Man, I was trapped. You know, and these people have legally adopted me. So they were legally my parents. And I couldn't do nothing. You know, except to steal some alcohol when I could, do whatever else it was I could, you know, to get rid of the pain. And you know, and because of this program today, because of these 12 steps, I don't have to feel that stuff anymore. And I'm so grateful for that. You know, and if there's anybody that's struggling in here tonight, you know, with all these demons and all these other things that are going on in their head and in their heart, please hang on. Please hang on. You know, the book tells us, you know, and how it works. You know, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. And I beg you tonight, please, please hang on. Because it does get better. You know, when I walked in here, you know, I heard people like Pat W, you know, tell me, you know, that the, you know, best is yet to come. And I thought, how is that possible? Here's a man that had 40-some years, 38 years when I met him. 30-some years. The best is yet to come. You know, when I walked in that door, I couldn't imagine life without, with a drink or without one. I came around here many years. I never got this thing. You know why I got sober that day? It was God's divine intervention. Because I didn't want to stop drinking. I had planned to drink myself to death, and it was kind of like that movie on Leaving Las Vegas where Nicolas Cage just planned to die. But I could never achieve that. But I wanted to. I could never make myself sick enough. You know, I could never drink enough. You know, I hear people like Claude would talk about, you know, when he would buy a liquor, you know, to take the top off and throw it away because that thing was for shipping purposes only. And that's the way that it was. That's what it was. That cap was for shipping purposes only. You know, I never went into bars and sat there with my finger up in the air, you know, sipping these little, hell no, I took the damn bottle, man, I'd drink it, you know. I would turn it up, and I would just keep going right on back, you know. And I would hit the floor. You know, I don't know how many times I've been picked up and thrown out of a bar head first. You know, a lot of times into a police car, but, you know. You know, yeah, there's a lot of jails and institutions in my life also. You know, when I was 19 years old, I was strapped down in a mental institution. You know, and I was in a mental institution. Alcoholic insanity. I'm 19 years old. You know, I should be out, you know, doing whatever it is 19-year-old kids do. You know, you ever see that movie Men of Honor where Robert De Niro's laying on that bed, you know, and he's screaming at the top of his lungs, you know, and they got him strapped down? That was me. And I was 19 years old. You know, and then my stepdad come in there, and they wanted me to talk to him because he was going to... Because I was out on bail when they had put me in this mental institution because I had kind of lost my mind a little bit, you know. And he wanted to come up there and tell me that when I got out of that mental institution that he was going to revoke my bond. And I picked a pool table up and threw it at him, literally. And when these orderlies, they brought about four or five of them, you know, to hold me down. They gave me a shot that they thought was going to knock me out. And it knocked me out for a couple minutes, and then they gave me another one. And, you know, when they strapped me down on this gurney, you know, the second shot they gave me thought was going to put me out, man. I stood straight up on that gurney like Frankenstein monster. And I beat the piss out of everybody that was in there. And it took, you know, and you ever heard Ron White talk about, you know, I don't know how many cops it was going to take to kick my ass, but I don't know how many they were going to use. That was kind of the way that it was, you know. And I knew how many people they had brought in there to get me. And I really don't remember how many days I was, but they had me in one of these, you know, one of those little nice little leisure suits, you know, that you get to get in that, you know, one of those rooms, you know, in those padded rooms. These are some of my finer moments in my life, you know. About a year later, I caused a bunch of trouble in the town where I was raised at, and they took me up before this judge, and the judge says, yes, I'm gonna give you a choice or a chance in your life. He says, you can either go to the penitentiary, or you can go in the Marine Corps. I said, well, I've already been convicted of one felony. I said, I'll never get in the Marine Corps. I said, just send me to jail. He said, no, he said, I've already made arrangements. If you want to go, he said, you got one chance. I go, okay. I'll be a patriotic son of a bitch, you know. And kind of ironic. I got out of the Marine Corps and went to the penitentiary anyway. I moved to California and got locked up for armed robbery. You know, Chuck a little bit ago was talking about, you know, being a low bottom drunk. You know, one of these times, you know, that I was drinking, you know, I always thought, you know, I'll never drink. You know, if it ever gets to the point to where I'm drinking rubbing alcohol or, you know, vanilla extract, lemon extract, you know, shoe polish, you know, Listerine, you know, I can go right on down the list. If it ever gets that bad, man, I'll quit. In 1994, man, I come in here and I got sober. I thought I had this thing. I thought I had it licked. And I celebrated a year up here, man. I was so proud, you know, man. And went home, got drunk. And I went out for 5 months and I come back in, and one time I came out of a blackout, man, and there was all this stuff laying around me. A couple of bottles of rubbing alcohol, vanilla extract, cooking sherry, vermouth, you know. I mean, just some of the most nasty rot gut stuff, you know. And I tell you what, if I had to go out and take a drink today, I guarantee you, if I don't go into a blackout and pass out, I'll be in the Wally World at 3 o'clock in the morning buying me a bottle of rubbing alcohol, mouthwash, whatever it is I can get in my mouth. Because, see, that's the way that I drink. Let me run out of alcohol before I pass out or go into a blackout, and I will drink anything. I will drink anything. You know, I came in and out of here for many years and I didn't get this thing. And I saw people who were, you know, who had come in here for many years, you know, and were sober, you know, and I thought, you know, what, why does it work for them? It's not working for me. You know, the book talks about being beat into a state of reasonableness. And that's exactly what I had to be. I had to go out and I had to use and I had to drink and I had to do all these things and be beat into a state of reasonableness. I had to be beat into a point to where, you know, we talk about surrender in here. And to me, surrender is if you're not taking directions or willing to take directions. You haven't surrendered. And when I walked back in these rooms, you told me to make that coffee. I wouldn't ask why. You told me to pick up ashtrays. I didn't ask why. You know, my good friend Edgar, you know, I get up here and I have to mention him. Man, saved my life. If it were not for that man, I might not be here tonight. He used to call me up on Saturday and Sunday afternoon, and he'd ask me, chair to me, and tell me, I don't want a chair to me. I didn't ask if you wanted to. Chair to me. When I came back in these rooms, there's another guy, Jimmy Ox. Sitting right back there in the middle of that table. He's right at a 6 o'clock meeting, and I'm back there running my mouth. Hell, I probably had 30 days sober, man. I thought I knew it all. And I'm running back there, running my mouth, laughing, cutting up, and Jimmy Ox turned around and slapped me in the back of the head. He said, why don't you shut the fuck up and pay attention and listen? He said, you might just hear something to get you sober. I was a mad little son of a bitch when he hit me. but I promise you tonight, that's another time that somebody saved my ass. See, because when I walked back in here, people didn't cut me any slack. Nobody cut me no slack at all. And I'm grateful for that. And some of the people in here that I don't cut any slack. That's just why I do it. You know, because I hope maybe that the people that I don't cut some slack, you know, will get this thing. You know, I don't ask a lot of people, the people that I ask to read, I don't ask it to read. I just say so-and-so is going to read. And see, that's what they did for me when I came in here. You know, I'm going on and on and on and on about all the crazy bullshit that happened in my life. You know, but my life is about recovery. You know, when I came in here on December 25th, 1995, you know, I came back here for two reasons. I came to the Howe place because, one, I knew that I wouldn't drink that day. And I knew that if I sat here all day, that I would be able to see my daughter and I would be able to get her the little dollhouse that I had bought her. It took me 6 months to pay for a little dollhouse about like this, you know. And I couldn't see her if I was drinking. Also came here because I knew they'd have food. And I knew I'd be able to get me something to eat. I went over to her mom's house that night. Put together a little dollhouse for her. When I was almost done, you know, all these people started coming in. It was a bunch of people that I had that I partied with. See, I live in the same area that I've always done a lot of my drinking. Not all of it. But ever since I've been here in Georgia. I hear people talk about, you know, well, I got to move here. I can't live there. You know, you got to change your playmates and your playgrounds. I had to change mine. The biggest playmate I had was me. The biggest playground I had was my mind. Those are the things that I had to change. I live in the same area, you know. I live right down the street. Then when I got sober, I live right across the street, you know. I used to go over here and rob this store right across the street every week. The little Indian man in there, he's grateful I'm sober. I go in there today, and he ain't got to watch the beer cooler no more. You know, I'm in there to pay for my gas, you know. You know, because when I go and come in there, you know, I mean, you know, I'd always sit in these weeds right over here. And man, I would wait for that store to fill up with people. And I would say, here's my chance. And I'd run across there, man, I'd grab me as much beer as I could, and I would hit that door. And he would see me coming. You know. And he couldn't get away from that cash register. I knew he wouldn't get away from that cash register. You know. And I knew as soon as he's reaching for that phone, man, he's calling Cherokee County. And I had to be quick, you know. He's grateful I'm sober, you know. But, you know, that's one of the amends that I had to make. You know, I had to go back in there and repay him for all that beer that I stole. You know. And one time I went in there, you know, and I took some money into him. I said, yes, I need to repay you some more. He said, no, you don't. Just don't do it anymore. Just don't drink anymore. I said, you're crazy. You know, all my life I heard people tell you, don't give that Indian no fire water. Man, they was right. But, you know, when I came back in here, you know, that night that I got sober, all these people started going into my ex's house. And I was This one guy come walking in, his name was Tattoo Scott, and he's the one to give me my tattoo. You know, and he walks over there, and he's got two big old cases of beer. He looks over, he says, "What are you doing here?" I said, "Oh, man, I'm putting together this little dollhouse." He said, "When you get done?" He says, "I got something." He says, "I got something for us." He reached in his pocket, and he pulled out a big old bag of some stuff and a couple of syringes, and he threw it at me, you know, and I don't know what happened. You know, I had hung around here all that day, Christmas Day, you know, on the day that I got sober. And I came in here, when he did that, you know, I got up, and I used the phone, and I called the Howe place. And the guy that was my sponsor at the time, he's the same person that took me to First Step. You know, first time I ever went to treatment, well, one of the first times I ever went to treatment, he took me to First Step. And this is the way that I drank. I was so drunk I couldn't even get in treatment center. I was so drunk, they took me to First Step. First Step said, "Nope, you gotta go sober him up and get him in here." I don't remember if Jody was with me or not. I don't know if you were with Bob or not that night. But, you know, then they took me to Kennestone Hospital. Kennestone Hospital refused me. They said, "We don't want him, he's gonna die. We don't want the responsibility." They said, "You need to go sober him up." That same person was the person that answered the phone that night. And when I called here at the Howe place on December 25th, 1995, you know, he didn't ask me. He didn't answer the phone and say, "Howe place." He picked the phone up. He said, "Where are you at?" He didn't know who it was, but he did know who it was. He said, "Where are you at?" I said, "I don't know, man." I was crying, you know, and for one of the first times in my life, I didn't want to get high. One of the first times in my life, I didn't want to drink. I said, "I don't know, but I think I'm in a trailer park right by the Howe place," and I said, "I really need to get out of here." He said, "I want you to leave wherever you're at," and he said, "I want you to start walking." And it wasn't 45 seconds later, because I hadn't probably got here to the front parking lot. And he had come flying around that corner. He knew exactly where I was. You know, sometimes God does for us that we can't do for ourselves. You know, and he knew. He didn't know where I was, but he knew where I was at. I didn't know where I was. You know, I had been out using for 5 months. And, you know, I got in the car and he brought me back up here. Man, I'm shaking, you know, all this alcohol, booze, and all this stuff's coming out of me. And I stood right out on them front steps, and I said, "Hey, man," I said, "I need to go to treatment." He said, "I ain't taking you no damn where." He said, "You either go in there," he's got one or two choices. "You go in there and you get sober, or you go get drunk." And that's what I did. I come in here and I got sober. You know, and since I've been here, you know, when I first got here, it wasn't easy, because I sat in these chairs and I literally held on to them. Shook and shaked and rattled and rolled and detoxed and sweated, and, you know. But, you know, since I've been here, you know, this program has given me many, many, many things. Many blessings, you know, and a lot of them, most of them are from in here. I don't hate that person that I look at in the mirror every morning. I don't look at that person in the mirror and say, "I hate you, you're disgusting. I hope you die." I can look at that person in the morning and I can say, "I like you." And every once in a while, I can even say, "I love you." I told you when I first started this thing, you know, that I was taken away from my people. In the year 2001, I had started. For many years, I had sat on bar stools and wherever I was, you know, and say, man, I'm one of these days, I'm going to open my adoption records and I'm going to find out who I am, what I am, where I'm from. You know, 2001, I had started that search. Went to the state of Wisconsin and found a program. It was an adoption research program. I told the lady who I was and what I wanted to do. And she said, well, what do you know about yourself? And I told her what my name was, and I told her who I thought I was, and I told her who I thought my people were and where I thought they were. She sent me a little form I had to fill out, and I sent it back to her. You know, I think it was about 2 weeks later she called me up. So I got some good news for you. So I got your adoption files opened up, so I'm gonna send them to you. So she sent me my files, and I started reading all about, you know, who I was and, you know, where I was from. She called me back a couple days later. She said, I'm going to send you another form. She says, I want to know if you want to find out if any of your family is still alive and do they want to see you. I said, okay. So I filled this little piece of paper out, sent it back to her. You know, it was about another 2 weeks later. She calls me up. And I was driving, I was working somewhere, and I was on the interstate, so we played phone tag for about an hour or so. I'd call her back, she'd be off the phone, she'd call me back, you know, and this went on for about an hour, and finally I got a hold of her, you know, and she said, what are you doing? I said, well, I'm driving right now. She said, I need you to pull over alongside the road for a minute. She said, I have some things I want to talk to you about. It's okay. So I pulled over alongside the road. She says, are you stopped? And I said, yeah. She says, I have your mom on the other line. And she wants to talk to you. And she told me, she says, this lady says, you know, she told me that to tell you that if she never got an opportunity to ever speak to you in person, to not blame her because she didn't give me away. Because see, those people that adopted me told me that these people didn't want me. That all the Indian people up on this, up on the reservations, we're giving their kids away. And see, I was caught up in an adoption, Indian Child Removal Act. Took hundreds of thousands of Indian children away from their families and homes. So I filled out this piece of paper. Couple weeks later, you know, I get all this information, and I had to call this lady again, and she gives me my mother's phone number. But see, while I was talking to her on this phone the first time, she says I have your mother on the phone, and she says I have you on the phone. She says I have two phones in my hand. She said, and I could hear my mom yelling over the other phone. That's how loud she was yelling. You tell him I did not give him away. You tell him that it is not our fault and that I want to see him. You know, it was probably a month later. You know, I was talking to my mom. I still have all the letters she gave me, all the birthday cards. I only have one birthday card from her. April of 2002, I was on a plane to Minneapolis, Minnesota. Got to meet my family. You know, I went through Minneapolis, you know, airport. And, you know, they told me that they'd meet me there. And, you know, they were wanting to know what I looked like. And, you know, I was kind of wondering what they looked like, you know. And I walked through the airport, man, come down this great big old long escalator. And, you know, as I come through these little security gates, you know, there was these few little girls that were standing there. One of them was my niece, and she goes, "There's Robert." And I turned to the corner. There was my mother. My sister. And another sister. I got seven sisters. You see, that big hole that we all talk about. You know, that one that the wind blows through. One that no matter what we did to ourselves, we couldn't fill up. Was gone. See, because when I saw her, I knew why it was there. And when she wrapped her arms around me, I literally heard that hole closed. And it was like a vacuum. It was one of the eeriest sounds I've ever felt and heard in my life. That day had a beautiful family reunion. You know, when they sent a limo from the casino up there to pick us all up, or to pick me up. My mom and my sisters escorted me out to this limousine. Had this guy out there, a little hat, you know, the white gloves, a little suit and all this stuff, you know. And this limo was probably, man, was about as long as this room. And the guy walks up to the door, man, opens it up. You know, and I go to get in, man, I look in there. Man, there was probably about 50 Indians in that thing. You know, and they had a stock bar, man. I mean, this bar was stocked. And they was like, "Man, you want something to drink?" And I was like, "No." I said, "No, do not give me any alcohol." You know, August 22nd of that same year, I was laying in the bed about 6 o'clock in the morning. My sister calls me up and she says, she told me some words that I always wanted to hear, but not in this way. She said, "You need to come home." She said, "Mother just died." You know, had it not been for this program, had it not been for God's divine grace, I would not have been able to do that. I would not have been able to get on that plane to fly back home to bury my mother, much less do it sober. You see, I come in here. And when I came in here, some people used to know my other name. I don't recognize and honor that name today. Because see, when I went home, they always used to ask me, "When are you going to change your name?" So right after we buried my mother, we had this great big feast, big ceremony. My whole family comes up to me and they said, "When are you going to change your name?" So when I go home, before my mother died, she handed me my birth certificate that she had held on to for 42 years. My name is Robert Sutton. That was my father's name. I never met him. From what I hear, I was just like him and he was just like me. You know, I was given a, when I changed my name back, I was given my Indian name back. Received a lot of benefits from my tribe. You know, since then I've had a son. You know, which I, at first I thought was a mistake. Because it was one of those things that just kind of happened. But today it's one of the greatest blessings of my life. You know, part of God's sense of humor too, because he thought I was done. The little boys taught me more about life and about patience and about tolerance and about how to be kind and loving to a little child. You know, just like to say, you know, that, you know, for you people out there who are just coming in or just coming back, or even maybe somebody that's struggling, you know, the best is yet to come. Just hold on. You know, don't quit 5 minutes before that miracle happens. You know, because this book right here is full of promises. Full of promises. And I just want to read a little something. If I can find it. Maybe I won't. Since the last 15 years of my life have been rich and meaningful. I've had my share of problems, heartaches, and disappointments, but that is life. But also I have known a great deal of joy and peace that is the handmaiden of an inner freedom. I have a wealth of friends, and with my AA friends, an unusual quality of fellowship. For these people, I am truly related, first through mutual pain and despair, and later through mutual objectives and newfound faith and hope. And as the years go by, working together, sharing our experiences with one another, and also sharing a mutual trust, understanding, and love, without strings, without obligations, we acquire relationships that are unique and priceless. There is no more aloneness with that awful ache. So deep in the heart of every alcoholic that nothing before could ever reach it. The ache is gone and never need return again. Now there is a sense of belonging and being wanted and needed and loved. And in return for a bottle and a hangover, we have been given the keys to the kingdom. So please hold on. Don't give up. Because, you know, as many times that I wanted to give up. And, you know, had I given up right before, you know, I wouldn't be here today. Because I know one thing that I don't know. I got one more drunk in me. But I don't know if I got any more recovery stuff. I'm not willing to pick those dice up and roll them anymore. Because I don't want I have to go back and just hope that maybe I can walk back through that door again. Because I know that this is not going to kill me anytime soon. But again, I would like to thank each and every one of you for being here tonight. And you know, when I walked in here, it was hard for me to be able to say that I love you, but thank you. And if God doesn't, you know, if nobody's told you that they love you today, God does, and so do I. Thank you.